As we come to starting off this sort of missions week, I want to start off with this video, and this is Francis Chan speaking at another missions conference, and there's Chinese subtitles on the bottom. I was thinking about showing this in the Chinese service, but he has some, if you've not heard Francis Chan, he's very passionate about us as Christians actually living faith, living our life out. So let me just roll this clip, and you guys can have a look.
Could you give a challenge to the Western church and the Western world?
Okay.
And then anything else that's burning on your heart.
Okay.
Generation.
Okay. I'm pretty excited when I see the faith of some of the young people today that are just saying, God, I'll go anywhere. I'll do anything. There wasn't a lot of that when I grew up. But what happened with those who did have that spark and that excitement, I saw how the church almost squashed them. And I'm praying for this next generation, for the young people who are just saying, I'll go anywhere, I'll do anything. And they're doing it. They're going overseas, or they're, you know, right where they're at in the inner cities or in their own suburbs, just going, you know, I'm going to be radical. I'm going to follow Jesus completely. I want it all. I'm not about the games and about, okay, entertain me to death in the church. I want to follow Jesus and I want to experience him. And I guess my challenge to the church is for those that are maybe my age or those who are even further along. It's like, would you set the example for the young people? Because what happened in my generation when we were younger, there were those who were radical, but there weren't people. Once they got married, everything changed. Once they had kids, everything changed. And I'm just praying, oh God, could I be an example of someone who's married and has kids and is still thinking kingdom first? Like saying, you know, like 1 Corinthians 7, those who are married should live as though they're not. There's a sense in which this mission is bigger, and can we still live and take risks and still surrender our lives and say, you know what, it's me, my wife, my family, I want to demonstrate to them, you know what, look, when we follow Christ, yeah, that was a little scary, yeah, that might have been a little dangerous, yeah, that was not the, you know, logical move to make, but God did call us that direction, and let's head that way, and I want my kids to experience what it looks like when we live by faith. But not only that, I want to be an example to the young people to say, you know what, your mission with the Lord doesn't end when you get married and suddenly, oh, well, you're dating, so focus on each other, and oh, it's your first year of marriage, you know, just focus on each other, and oh, you just had a kid, you know what, then take time for that little kid, and until he goes to school, then you'll be free. But then once they're in school, it's like, oh, they're teenagers now, just collect that family together and worry about yourselves. But then you're teaching them this mentality that, again, is not about going out in the harvest and being a worker. It's about, let's protect our family now, let's keep us safe, let's find some gated community, and, you know, and keep them all in our house away from all the bad people. And that's there's no excuse for that. That is not what, you can't find that in this book. It's about living for him, and you're missing out. Not only are you missing out on life, but your children are missing out on life when you do that. That's why so many of the kids, when they turn 18, they just ditch God altogether, because they didn't see anything real in your life. They didn't see that adventure, and you didn't put yourself in positions where God had to come through, and then he comes through, and your whole family was going, wow, that was amazing. I am never going to leave that God. No, you just created a little bubble for yourself where how was God even going to operate in that? And I don't know. I don't want to be negative. I don't want to sound negative. I just get sad because I go, not only are you missing out on life, but we are turning away our children by the droves because our lives are not the adventure that they see in Scripture, and they are not experiencing the Holy Spirit. They're experiencing like a Christian version of the American dream that's watered down, and we just make excuses for really idolizing our families rather than really putting Christ in the mission first.
So I thought I'd start off with that video. Just if I had one focus about this missions month, it would be to get that idea resonating in our hearts to say, you know, actually, what has Jesus called us to do? Who has he called us to really be? Because I think definitely as growing up in the West, we're always thinking about trying to how to protect ourselves or trying to make sure our kids get into the right schools or making sure we have our own money. But then the more I think about it, the more I realize, well, what is this teaching to my children? Do I really demonstrate that I trust and love God in my life? And it's really challenging. I want to talk a little about this guy, Richard. My goodness, good thing he's not around to hear me butcher his name. Robert Moffat. He was a Scottish, came from a poor family. When he was young, there are all these kind of anecdotes about him, but he became a believer in church. And apparently one time they're passing the offering plate around and he didn't have any money and he just stood on the plate and said, well, I have nothing, so I just give myself to God. And you don't know whether he was just being a cheeky kind of kid or how serious he was. But there was also another anecdote about him where the pastor of that church wasn't doing that well, so the elders wanted to kick him out. And he said, what have you done? There's been no converts in this church the years you've been here. And then the minister just looked and said, but what about wee Bobby? That's my Scottish accent, by the way. And it was just this one boy who had turned to Christ, and they said, well, fine, we give you that one. But actually, this boy, Robert Moffat, he was kind of following God, and I think he had a big turning point, and he was reading the Bible, and he was reading Romans. And he was reading through Romans, and as he read it, he was blown away, because I think for the first time he clicked who God was and how powerful he was. And he said, have I been reading these words wrong my whole life that I never saw this, but that God's grace and mercy are so real and so true. So he became more passionate. He was in Manchester, and there was a kind of a missions meeting at the time. So he walked into this church. He just goes into this church, and he listens to this talk about the missions. He's so inspired that he decides he wants to join a missions. And God begins to open doors for him, and he ends up going to South Africa when he was 21. So by 21, he moves to South Africa. Now, South Africa back then was not like South Africa now, right? So it wasn't populated. This was all pre-apartheid, so there wasn't even cities there. This was, they're just going out there. And he went out there, and he was in Cape Town at the time, and he just wanted to go further out. So he went out they said he'd have to walk past rivers and mountains and parts that were really dangerous. And he just went out, and this is one of the quotes. It's, in the vast plains to the north, I have sometimes seen in the morning sun the smoke of 1,000 villages where no missionary has ever been. And you get the zeal, this passion of there are people out there who don't know God, and I want to go out there. He ends up going out. So I have a line here. It says, his earliest ministries were treks taken into the interior. There were few railroads or roads, and oftentimes those were washed away by rains. Travel was difficult, dangerous, and often death-bringing. Rivers, rocks, swamps, and forests had to be avoided or mastered somehow. Intense heat by day and chill cold by night complicated travel. Always there were the wild beasts, lions, jackals, hyenas, crocodiles, snakes, monkeys, and worst of all, warlike and untrustworthy native bushmen. You have to understand, this is a Scottish guy, completely displaced now in Africa, wandering through these jungles, trying to find these tribes, hoping to share God with them. And of course, he wasn't dissuaded by all these hardships. And he found this tribe, and he set out, and he met this chief who was actually a bloodthirsty butcher of sorts. And he just tried to befriend them, eventually built a home there, lived with the people. And there's another anecdote of there wasn't rain, so the food wasn't growing. And so they asked the local medicine man, let there be rain. And so the local medicine man did all these things and tried to make these things, but rain wouldn't come down. And then eventually the medicine man said, it's the white-faced devil that is here that is causing the lack of rain. So everyone got together in the tribe to Robert Moffat, and they went to kick him out. And they were all at his door, and they were demanding that he would leave, otherwise they'd kill him. And he came out and said, you can threaten me with death, but I will stay here because of the love of God, and I will continue to love you and stay here. And apparently the medicine man was like, who is this person that is not afraid of death at all? And then they just dispersed. He eventually married this other English woman, and his wife actually stayed there with him. So for 50 years, they're out there. Amazing in ministry, just to go through this whole process and just kind of live in this kind of situation. And they had 7 children, and all the children. And it's quite amazing because one of the children eventually married David Livingston, who was another famous missionary. And apparently, it was Robert Moffat who convinced David Livingston not to go to China, but to go to Africa instead, because of the great need. What happened was he was kind of in the Bechuana tribe, and he spent ages there trying to win converts to them. But of course, no one wanted to believe, no one wanted to be part of knowing who God was. Until one day, the Bechuana tribe was about to be attacked by another tribe. In the biographies, I think they have different kind of names, because Zuluas. And Robert stood alongside the people and actually helped to get weapons to help protect the tribe. And afterwards, everyone saw how devoted and how faithful he was to the people, that they began to listen to him and began to embrace him. And he became part of the tribe. You have to understand, he had to learn the entire language. He had to learn how to live, to farm, to hunt, to be with these people. And then the people started to turn around. They started to listen to him. They started to come to the church, and then they started to believe. And before all this, there's another great anecdote, because his wife received a letter from their mission organization, London Mission. So they said, "Oh, is there anything you need? Anything we can send you?" And his wife wrote, "You have to understand as well. There's no, you're not telephoning, you're not telegraphing. You're not sending stuff necessarily by airplane. These things take ages to send a letter back and forth." And so the wife wrote back. She said, "Oh, send us a communion set, because even though there's no one to have communion yet, we will need it." Like, how much faith do you have? You've been living in this village for 20 years. Nothing's happened, and you're like, "Oh, yeah, we do need something. We need a communion set, because we're going to have communion eventually, and we want to be ready." And amazingly, then they do. Their little chapel that they built became full. The other tribes around the area began to hear about this white-faced missionary, and they would come and listen to him, and they would be amazed at the truth about who God was, and they would bring that back. And you began seeing this change. And one of the things that Robert Moffat also did was he said, "How can this people here not have their own Bible? You know, they can't even read them." So he spent his own time trying to learn the language and then translating the New Testament for them in their language. And you get this picture of like, wow, this guy is so much passion, so much life, this willingness to really go all out. That's kind of his story. And it's this quote, I think, that really caught my eye. You know, in the vast plain to the north, I have sometimes seen in the morning sun the smoke of 1,000 villages where no missionary has ever been. And if I broke that down for us, you know, my question would be, well, what do you see? Do you see the needs out there? What is the vast plain to the north for you? When you open your eyes and you look, even in the city of Birmingham or in your schools, do you see a place where actually people don't know who God is? What is the smoke of 1,000 villages where no missionary has ever been? Do you see actually parts of society, even with your own friendship circles, where people are yearning to know God, actually, that there's been no missionary? You're the only Christian there. You're the only Christian that they know about. When I think about this and I think about these three questions, I actually see that there's actually three problems. And there's three problems why we don't engage or we don't move forward. And the first problem that we have is actually we don't see a problem. You know, we don't see that there's something going on. And the big part with that is that we're a bit disconnected from society. Well, we might see problems in society, but then we complain that someone should do something about that, or why doesn't something do about that? Most commonly I hear is, why doesn't the church do something about this group? Or why doesn't the church have something for them? And so I get a lot of these suggestions. I call them helpful suggestions. People pass my way and say, oh, why doesn't our church have this? Why doesn't our church do this? And I sit there and think, well, because I only have so much time in the day, and I don't know. I can't do everything. And I always want to say, well, why don't you do it then? And you say, oh, but you know, I can't. I have all these kind of reasons. So sometimes we might see the problem, but we don't engage with it. The other part of where we don't see the problem is Francis Chan talked about a little bit gated communities, where I'll be honest with you. In the States, Chinese people do this a lot. Let me be more specific. So in my city, Monterey Park, you might have heard me say before, but we used to, the Ku Klux Klan used to be in our city. It used to be full of white people. If you've seen the Jason Chen video with Bubz Beauty in it, they basically, in the end of that video, they have a dance on this fountain. That fountain is right by my house, and the KKK used to meet on that fountain. So there's some history for you guys. All right, so what happened was, the Chinese people who worked hard, kept themselves to themselves, saved all their money, began to make money, said, well, we want to move into the richer areas, away from the black and the Mexican people. You know, that's what Chinese people are like. We want to move away from those people into our... So they moved into the white areas, and the white people said, well, we don't want to live here with the Chinese people. So they moved to San Marino, which was about 50 minutes north, and the Chinese people all moved into Monterey Park. So it's now full of Chinese people. It's what we call... it used to be the A1A, and Chinese people love that. But it's the 626 now, so if you guys ever heard that thrown around on Wang Fu, it's the 626, that's where I live. I'm hip. So it's full of Chinese people. In other words, people just want to stay with their own groups and not engage with other people. What happened eventually was Chinese people became richer because the next generation became doctors. And then the doctors said, well, we want to live here with the poor Chinese people and the Mexican anymore. We're going to move to San Marino. And then when they moved to San Marino and all the white people said, we don't want to live here. We'll move to Beverly Hills. So it's been a chase. It's basically, it's the way Chinese people try to take over the world. It's a very slow process. It's kind of a sad thing. My friend in Houston said, actually, the place where she lives, they don't have public transportation. They don't have buses. I was like, what do you mean you guys don't have buses? Oh, no, there's no municipal transport in the city. Everyone drives. I said, why don't you guys have buses? Because we don't want poor people taking the bus into the city. I was like, what is wrong with America? What city council decides, oh, we don't want buses because if we have buses, the poor people from the other cities can take the bus into the city. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's ridiculous. But it's not that different from actually the way we think about things. It's why we don't always want to hang around in the poor places of town. It's why when we drive through parts, we lock our doors because we're afraid. It's like we're less committed to being around people of different races and different cultures or different backgrounds. It's like we will secretly judge people in a full burqa, or we drive through areas like Spark Hill or Nichols. We will judge because we don't want to be around those people. We want to be safe where we are. And when we don't engage with those other cultures, we don't see a problem. It's funny because sometimes we don't even see the problems with our own communities, with our own English or Chinese communities. We turn a blind eye to it. Now, this is a challenge because if we don't learn to see the problem or the needs, our hearts don't get moved to compassion. We don't be inspired to live out. We don't ever take steps of faith. I think of this passage in Matthew chapter 9, verses 10 to 13, where Jesus is sitting at this table. And as Jesus reclined at table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? But when he heard it, he said, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. For I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, a lot of times, there's a subset of Christians, mostly teenagers, who will use this as an excuse to hang out and go to clubs and party and do all these things. Say, I'm just hanging out with the tax collectors and sinners just like Jesus did. And then you look them in the eye, you know, no, you're not there as a Christian. You're there as everybody else. And in other words, your heart's there. What's different here is Jesus in this scenario is saying, actually, these people are drawn to me because they're ill, because they want something different, because they're hungry for a change. In other words, their hearts are open. They're yearning for truth, and they want to know who Jesus is. The key part here is where actually Jesus says to the Pharisees, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And this is an awesome line, because Jesus is setting himself up as like, I am God, because this is taken from Hosea chapter 6, verse 6. And Jesus is actually saying, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. In other words, I'm just like God. I am God. And what's mercy? So this word mercy in Hosea 6, it's actually in Hebrew, it's translated more like steadfast love or compassion, this enduring love. With Jesus, he's saying, look, I'm asking for this demonstrable, real relationship of life poured out to people, not just living by religious performance or looking like a Christian or acting like one. But if you are really merciful, if you really have steadfast love, you will engage with the community around you, with the people around you. You have to be willing to open your eyes and see the problem. And that means not just looking at yourself or what's going on in your life. See, the thing is, actually, in our church, everyone, we're all broken. In fact, we're all hurting. We all have problems. We all have issues. We all have secrets. And then when different people come into the church, we actually want more broken, hurting, confused people in our church, because that's who we are. It seems like Jesus is saying, actually, yeah, we want the people who are hungry for Jesus, even if we don't understand them, even if we feel like it's a struggle to make conversation with them. Maybe they don't make it easily socially for us. Because Jesus isn't saying, oh, I want you guys to make a really nice social club where everyone's the same, is he? And Jesus says, bring me your sick, your lost, your lonely, your hurt, your marginalized. That's who we should be hungry for. And when they come into church, it should be us eager to speak to them and say, you know, I struggle too. Or I want to just pray for you. In fact, I just want to bring you to God, and we all need this kind of support. Too often, we have a picture of what a Christian should be like, which is maybe okay. But then what's worse is we have a picture of what a non-Christian who's almost a Christian would be like. Like, this person will fit into our church, because they're like kind of middle class. They're Chinese or BBC. I think they'd get along with our friends. So I think they could be a satisfactory kind of person entering into our secret club, which is depressing. That's not what you want, is it? That's not what a church should be like. It should be full of the people who are messed up. And does it make life more difficult? Does it make sometimes less fun in church? Maybe. But gosh, what if that was you? What if you're the one who is a little bit different or struggling socially or find it hard to make friends? What if you need to find some place where actually people could talk to you and engage with you? We need to be that place. And I think that's what was special about Jesus, right? Jesus didn't just look at these tax collectors and sinners and judge them or condemn them. He saw them, and they knew that actually he was welcoming them into a journey, into a process of life which was different. He gave them hope. What's even greater is that Jesus could actually solve and heal and bring them to new places. What's amazing for us is we have that same power. We say, Jesus, come into this person's life. Do a transformation. We have to start understanding what it means to walk with someone from when they're healthy to when they're ill, to when they pass away. Like, I think to myself, there's a Julianne Moore just recently won an Oscar for her portrayal of Alice, and it's a woman who is slowly suffering with dementia and coming to terms with what that means. Now, a lot of us are young, so we don't think about dementia. We don't think about what it means to get old. We don't think about what it means for us to have old people in church because we're so young. But I think about it. I think about, well, one day, what if I get dementia? Would the church help me? I don't know. I don't know if they would. I don't know. Because it's hard. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to help other people. And so I think, well, would I help someone? How much would I go? And I realized I couldn't just do it by myself. How do we help one another? We have to start thinking about that. Actually, yeah, I have to see beyond myself. Maybe God wants us to learn how to... Maybe when God says love one another, he's actually talking about actually committing to one another's lives. That struggle, that journey. Which is why it's important to start seeing not just your own kind of sector, but seeing the generations above you and below you and saying, actually, we need to be part of this whole journey of demonstrating faith in all kinds of circumstances. And so I ask, you know, these questions again. What do you see? You know, what is the vast plain to the north? What is the smoke of 1,000 villages where no missionary has ever been? You can start here, just looking in this congregation. Do you know your brother and sister here? Have you had a conversation with them? Actually, do you even know where they are, what their background is? I think one of the best questions to ever ask is, are you a Christian? How did you become one? What's your story? When we start thinking like this, it doesn't mean like it's saying, okay, well, I need to try to invite them to every kind of social engagement or occasion that I'm part of. But when you begin to love someone as your family member, it's saying, okay, well, I want to be there for you when things get hard. And I hope you will be there for me as well. What happens in this congregation when someone falls ill? What will happen to you if you fall ill? When trials and persecution come, who will walk alongside you? And when you see someone else going through trials and persecution, will you be walking alongside them? One of the reasons we tried or are working on these life groups is because we want those places where actually you have a chance to start to know one another a little bit more, where you have a chance to actually say, I want to invest in this kind of relationship so that I can know, so that when hard times come, I know at least my first port of call is I can turn to you. I'll be honest with you. Normally, I'm a person's last point of call. They're like, okay, well, it's gotten so bad in my life now, I'm going to call. This is how I treat a dentist, okay, basically. My mouth has gotten so bad, I need to call a dentist now. And then what will happen is you'll go into the dentist and they will scold you for not taking care of your teeth. And if you come to me at the last moment, I will sit there and go, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. I'm only 40. I need to wait till I'm 60. I'll have some great wisdom or something. I'll say, all I can do is pray for you. I'll do my best, but I don't know. There's almost this thing where actually, well, maybe we should be helping each other more regularly along the way in prayer and support, because when the storms come, you're never ready. You don't know when that's going to happen. But family and community is about saying, okay, well, I got to start. I want to know. Now, there's two points of emphasis here, though, okay? So on one hand, there's those of us who are like, okay, well, yeah. Okay, I got to be more proactive. I got to speak to some people that I haven't talked to before. I need to just start to broaden my horizons. The other half is the people who are like, okay, well, I am already going through a hard time. Maybe someone will come and talk to me. Maybe someone will. The impetus is also on you to say, well, actually, no, I have to make a first move too. We can't always be waiting for someone else. We have to start somewhere. And I'll tell you what, there will be times when you try to talk to someone and actually they're blowing you off. They're not really. Okay, and I think the first thing we want to do is to say, I hate this church, stupid people. It's always like this. Every church I've been to, it's all the same. They're so fake. All right, look. We all got problems. None of us are perfect. And so the first person you talk to might be going through a hard time too. And if it's not working, then there's other people in church. Thankfully, there's more than three people in this church. Otherwise, it would be very awkward if we all didn't like each other. Don't make that happen, please. Just keep coming. There's this idea then, okay, well, let me find someone else. Let me try. The second problem that I sort of see with this is that there's this idea where it's not my problem. It's someone else's responsibility. It's out of my jurisdiction. And I think when we start on a broad scale, I think we always think, well, why doesn't the government do this? Why doesn't the government sort out their immigration policy? Or why does the government make it so difficult for us to get visas? Or why doesn't the government stop taxing this thing? And why don't they do this? Why does the government start choosing to make every school fee so high? And we want to blame the government for a lot of these things. But you break it down a little bit smaller, we say, well, why doesn't our church do this? Why doesn't our church make these things happen? Or even worse, is you start looking at another person in your house and say, well, why doesn't my wife do this? Or why doesn't my husband do this? Or why don't my children do this? Or why don't my children play violin and piano at the same time and are grade 20 in both of them and also have perfect grades? Like, because everyone, other kids, we all can't be Abraham. So, just kidding. I saw Sam tap you. That's why. So I'm gonna harass him now. Just kidding. We're all different. None of us can be Abraham. You can name your children Abraham, though, in the future, should you want to, Ben and Mandy. Having a girl. Anyways. In other words, we don't look to them. And the reason we try to put the blame onto someone else is because we say, well, I've got my own problems. I've got my own situation to deal with. I've got my own life to kind of live. And I think Francis Chan touched on it really well. We say, look, I've got my family. I got to work about my family first. If I take care of them, then when I have time, I will think about other people. I'll work on that. Or I got my job. You know, I'm really worried about my job and really frustrated about it. Or I'm trying to think about change up. Or I'm moving house right now. I'm going to move house. I got to think about my house. I'm going to move on. Or, you know, my kids are about to take their 11 plus. Or my kids are going to go to university. Or I'm in university now. I have no money. I just have an infinite amount of time. You know, just a million different reasons, have different excuses that we come up with that just tries to take the responsibility off from us. We're just saying, well, someone else's problem. Someone else can look after the sick or the weird or the different. It's not my responsibility. In fact, a lot of times what we do, we want someone to set up a committee or some sort of corporation or some sort of group. Oh, we need to have a working group. If we can get a working group together, then they can do it together. You know, it's impossible trying to get a working group together because no one wants to be in the working group because they want someone else to be doing it. And then when you finally get that group together, there'll be that one person who's really keen, and then the four other people who are like, oh, I felt bad because Bert asked me to be on this, so that's why I'm here. And they'll just try to offload all the work to that one person who's really passionate for it. And it's just not right, is it? It's kind of empty. When we start saying, actually, God, you've given me everything in my life. Why am I afraid to trust you with it? And we'll start with an easy one. Children. Children, you're always saying, okay, well, now that I have children, I've got to make sure I'm really worried about their education. I want to move into a good area where they'll be by good schools. And I'll be honest, this is what we did. My wife made a whole matrix, and she plotted all this stuff out. She said, what's a good primary school area? And then it's like, okay, well, we're trusting our abilities to find these good schools. And then it's like, well, do we really trust God? Are we really demonstrating to our children that we trust God? It's tough because actually we moved into our school area, and at first it was Ofsted rated outstanding. And then by the time Alex went through that year, it got downgraded to good or whatever it is. And then because you've already made that choice as parents, you're like, oh, well, now it's good. It'll make the school work harder so they can get back to the outstanding. You just delude yourself because you're already stuck there. And you also like, and I remember we had this discussion because they're like, well, there are no good secondary schools in this area. You know, he could end up sounding really, really brummy. Even worse, he could sound really black country. What are we going to do? And as parents, we really want to protect our children because we don't want them not to have bad accents, but we're afraid that they're going to... Sorry, it's okay. I'll admit, I don't want my child to grow up in Cardiff. I burned the bridge to ever move into that church if I ever get fired from this one. Okay. Sorry, Pastor Sam. okay, anyways, we'll move on from Cardiff. I love I can't say it. It'd be a lie. Where was I? Oh, we have this idea that somehow we're in control, and you become more frustrated when you're pursuing that. And I remember when we were talking, kind of fast, I said, well, you know what? So if Alex doesn't get into a grammar school, would we ever send him to a private school? And I said, well, very simply, no, because we can't afford it. So that, thankfully, we don't have that problem. We don't ever have to think about that because we're never going to be able to provide him to go to private school. So, but what if they end up going to like the local, I don't know, the school, you know, one of those bad ones? I said, well, maybe God can use him to be an influence there. Just thinking, that's a lot of burden for a child, isn't it? And I said, well, we have to trust God, actually. Because actually, we've seen a lot of students. I've seen a lot of kids go to grammar schools. I've seen a lot of kids go to Great King Edward School. And in the end, they come out. So everyone's like the same. It's like there's not necessarily a huge difference unless they've had... It's, a lot of times you find more it's about the families and the support and the care. And actually, as a Christian, you realize actually it's more just spending time with your child praying and talking through things. And it's tough. I tell you as a parent, it's tough because on one hand, we want to protect them so much. We want to keep them safe. We want to make all the decisions best for them. And we should do as we can, but we also need to have faith. We also need to trust God. We need to say, actually, God, you're the one who gave me this child, so I trust that you will open the right doors. You will make the path straight. And I tell you as a parent, that is one of the hardest things to actually trust God in this way. With your marriages the same way, with your in-laws, with your friends in schools, but when you have to start saying, actually, God, I wanna trust you. See, the more you try to hold on to something, the more fear you have. But when you are able to finally let it go, you say, actually, God, then I can trust you. It's very different than when you pray through things with your family about issues, because you've got to come together because you have no choice. You've got to have that kind of openness. You've got to deal with those issues because, God, we have to come before you. I tell you, it's a struggle for me, really hard to think through this. Because my normal Chinese family said, okay, you've got to aim for these kind of goals. This is what you're living for. And then now trying to bring it back. And it's funny because now that my mom and dad are both Christians, they just keep saying the same. You just, you know, pray. You got to trust God. I'm like, oh, Mom and Dad, why didn't you? It would have been a lot easier if you trained me up this way to be trusting God instead of suddenly becoming a Christian later in life and then deciding that actually God is more important than these things. My mom always says, "Oh, why do you fight? Don't waste your time fighting. You should just pray together. I'll fix your fight faster." I was like, "You're probably correct, but I'm pretty sure when I'm angry, I would rather fight than." Then sit down and pray. But I realize that, you know, when you begin to have more faith in God, when you begin to seek him more, when you say, actually, God, it's not someone else's problem, but I want to be involved in this world around me. I want to give of my life and my time for these people. It's opportunity to actually demonstrate faith. And especially for those of us who feel like our spiritual life is so stagnant, it's not going anywhere. Oh, I just feel like, oh, I can't hear God. Maybe you can't hear God because you're not doing anything. If you're not with the marginalized, or if you're not with the poor, if you're not suffering persecution, then you're just being a normal white middle-class person, right? Unless you're not white. Just a normal middle-class person just doing the everyday. Do you believe that God has called us for more? That he's put you in your workplaces, brought you into your universities, put you in these families for a purpose. Because I think he has. It's funny, when we go to the government level and we complain about a government not making changes, you do realize you live in a democracy. The strangest thing about living in a democracy is that you have the power to affect change. Yes, there's probably a ton of bureaucracy in the way before going there, but you have the power to make change, actually. And yet, we as Christians, we shy away. We just play by the rules instead of saying, actually, well, maybe we can make a change. I think of Robert Moffin. I think, well, he goes out there and he's diligent in living this life of faith for years, but he knows where his North Star is, you might say. He knows where his direction is, and that is God, and that is him loving these people. He said this is, he doesn't look at those tribes out there and say, well, it's not my problem. He's like, God, how do I get there? What do I have to do? What if that was our thing? What if we were hungry like that? God, actually, what do I have to do? What would it take for me to get out there? So we ask those questions again. Oh, this is this verse, Romans 10. How then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. I remember what Cain and Abel, their conversation. And Cain says to God, am I my brother's keeper? Am I responsible for my brother? He's trying to absolve blame. You know what I think? When I get to heaven and I'm standing before God, is this going to be the question I ask him? When he says, you know, Bert, you are the only you're only a missionary to this group of friends that you're with. And did you ever say anything to them? Did you ever talk to them about God? Would I say to God, am I my brother's keeper? It's not my problem. We have such a short time here on earth, and yet God brings us into contact with so many people, so many lives, actually so many hurt and broken people that are longing for some truth or someone to pray for them. And yet we're so afraid. We're afraid of atheism. We're afraid of Islam. We're afraid of Buddhism. We're afraid of different cultures. In other words, we don't believe that our God is so big and so great that every soul hungers to know him. Do you know every soul is hungry to know God? But how will they know unless they hear? How will they know unless someone preaches to them? How will they know unless someone is sent to go to them? And hasn't God sent you to all these places where you are now to go, to hear, to speak? What do you see? What is the vast plain to the north? What is the smoke of 1,000 villages where no missionary has ever been? The third problem, and the final problem, just if you're curious, I have 3 points today, is that we always say that we need more equipping. And I think that's probably our most common excuse, because we say, well, I just don't know what to do. I don't feel like I'm ready to go Bible college, but I feel like I need Bible college to actually move forward in my life. I'll tell you this, in Romans 12:1, it says, do not be slothful in zeal, be fervent in spirit, serve the Lord. You living in the West have the most access to all sorts of teaching about Christ, more so than ever before in the history of time. You can Google a million different things. You can learn a million different things. You can learn so much about God. You can see examples of how to evangelize if you want to. You can find a bazillion YouTube videos, some of them really badly made, some of them really good, and the content being, you know, some of it really great. And you can actually say, actually, God, if I really was serious about being equipped, I could be equipped, actually. Even if Bert gave me like 4 references to look up, that would already equip me more than ever. But I'll tell you, when we say I'm not equipped, it just means that I haven't gotten around to being equipped yet. And I just can't be bothered. Because I think one of the common things is, oh, Bert, why don't our church have like adult Sunday school classes? I think we would totally love, and I said, yeah, I would love that. I would love to be able to do that. And we've done it before in the past, and all 4 people who came, I think, really enjoyed it. And there's a sense of us saying, oh, yeah, that's what we really want, and I'd really be committed to going to it. But actually, no, actually, if you're committed to God, you can grow. It's without a doubt. If you really want to grow in God, you can grow. there's no reason why you should be stopped. Because firstly, there's the Bible, which you could read. If you don't understand it, there's 1,000 commentaries out there, which are available in libraries, also on bookstores, on Amazon, which you could easily buy by spending money instead of coffee. But that involves reading. Well, then I guess you're not that serious, so don't complain to me about not being equipped, because you could. I just want someone to teach me. Fine, you can go on YouTube. You can listen to sermons. There's a ton of sermons out there. You can listen to preachers. In fact, iTunes University has a bunch of free courses that you could go through if you really wanted to hear theology courses. There's like a ton to go through. In other words, the only thing that's stopping us from being equipped is a lack of zeal, a lack of passion. And I tell you, when you're shopping for something, when you're looking and you want to buy something, wow, how zealous are you to compare prices? To go and look and look to see color matches. How zealous were you to figure out whether that dress was gold and white or blue and black? There was zeal there, and yet, oh, you know why, Bert? You know why I'm zealous for that? It's because that's fast. I can do that quickly. Yeah. And how long do you spend down that rabbit hole called YouTube watching a bazillion videos of nothing? In other words, if we have zeal for the Lord, you will be equipped. And that's one of the things we're saying, well, okay, then do it. There's a whole plain to the north and thousands of tribes who have never heard Christ. And what are you doing about it? When you get to heaven, are you just going to say, well, God, I was planning to, but then I saw this cat video. And then after that one, there was like another cat video. And I think Satan uses YouTube because another video will just come up. And I just have to wait 5 seconds and I can skip that ad. And so then before you know it, I just didn't have time. I just didn't have time, God. I think I'm becoming more convicted that this world is desperate for Jesus. People are hungry to know him. And it's like, what are we doing about it? My thing is, I'll be honest, I'm doing it the lazy way. I'm waiting for someone to approach me. And God has been gracious because someone emailed me out of the blue asking for help that doesn't know me, doesn't know anything. I'm like, oh God. And I think he used that to open my eyes to say, like, Ashley, people are so hungry, they would cold call email you out of the blue for help. And Bert, what are you doing about the lost? What can you play? I'm sure, as church members, you're like, yeah, Bert, exactly. Are you going to start an evangelism committee? And I tell you now, no. I'm just going to do it by myself. And eventually, you might come along for the ride. But the power of evangelism starts with you guys saying, well, actually, you know what, Bert, you're right. I'm going to go try this on my own, too. I don't have to wait for a team. I don't have to wait for you to organize a team and call a meeting and have a debate about it and then discuss methodology and then finally go out. You know what? Maybe we should just start by just trying and going out and speaking. And then eventually coming and sharing about what God has been doing. The biggest thing I've seen actually about seeing your spiritual life grow is faith. Having the faith to actually try. To believe what God can do. The second thing about I need more equipping is actually this whole part in Romans 12. So I started out reading Romans 10, and I didn't read all of Romans because that's so wonderful. I love Romans; it's so good. If you are not Christian and you have a thinking mind and you like want to understand, just read through Romans. Just read through Romans, and you'll be like convicted. And you'll be like, "Oh my gosh, this is brilliant! This is so good." Anyways, so Romans 12 just basically said, "This is what it means to be a believer. This is how you know Christ is demonstrating in your life. Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor." Do not be slothful in zeal, be fervent in spirit, serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer, contribute to the needs of the saints, and seek to show hospitality. In other words, if you are not equipped, then just do these things. Just do this. If this is the bare minimum you can do, do this in your workplace, in your schools, and I tell you, you will begin to demonstrate Christ. And God will open up opportunities, and you say, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to talk to them about Jesus, but they're asking, so I'm just going to talk to them. when I think about Robert Moffat, this is actually what he did. He did mostly this most of his time. And yes, he had to try to preach and do his services, but no one would come to those and no one would listen. He just lived this out. And eventually, their hearts were opened. If Christians live this out in your workplace, in your schools, if you lived with honor above everyone else, not in terms of pride, but in terms of love, wouldn't we really begin to reflect who Christ is? The verse goes on. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. This is, when I read this, I just think of those Christians who were killed, the 21 Christians in Egypt, and those families who were saying, we want to bless them. I'd invite them to our house. I'd invite ISIS into our house because I would say, you know, because God has saved my son. God has saved my brother. And I want you to know, I want your eyes to be open to the truth. I'm like, wow, that is real, that is true, that is this verse alive. And here we are complaining about the fact that it took a little bit longer at McDonald's for them to prepare my food, or somehow that the burger who came out is worse than it. It's always worse. It can never be worse than worse. We can complain about a million different things. But do we bless? We don't bless those who persecute us because we don't take any risks to actually be persecuted. We're too safe. We can't live this verse out. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, which means proud, but associate with the lowly. Again, that's actually talking to people which are different culture, different people to you. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. See that? That equips you. You do that, and that is the first step. If you're too lazy to be zealous for the Lord, to go and research and actually learn, then start with this. And you begin to let God actually permeate your life, your attitude, your thinking, your behavior, your relationships, your workplace. So I ask one more time, what do you see? What is the vast plain to the north? What is the smoke of 1,000 villages where no missionary has ever been? See, I don't think we have any excuses. We live in the very safe and comfortable West. But actually, Birmingham sits on the precipice, actually, just on the edge. It can be more dangerous for you if you want, actually. You can be bold. There are lots of opportunities to be bold. There are lots of opportunities to demonstrate love. Those choices and those chances are there for you every day. And you can choose to live by faith in Him, or you can just live like you have been every day. Just okay, mildly satisfied, nothing great, nothing bad. Or you can walk with Him. So we come back to Romans 10. How then will they call on Him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in Him whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach good news. Let's pray. God, you know, I pray this for myself and for anyone else who feels the same way, but Lord, will you forgive us for just taking for granted all the blessings that you've given us, for living in this sort of comfortable Christian bubble, and for ignoring the fact that you have given us so much and given us this amazing calling and challenge. Lord, there are unnumbered souls who are dying, and yet we still stay so silent. So forgive us, Lord, and then stir us into action. Let your Spirit push us and prompt us and lead us and challenge us and inspire us. Lord, and I know a lot of us are afraid. We don't know what to say. We're afraid that we aren't good enough as Christians, that our example isn't great. Father, then fill us with your Spirit to take away that fear, but to drive us with your passion and your purpose and your hope, to know that we are yours. We are children of Christ. So as we come and worship you now, Lord, and we open our eyes so that our worship isn't just idle words and empty praise, but let it be the words grip our hearts, to let the moment we step out of this church be a new moment where we are active and alive in your word. In Jesus' name, we pray.